Blog Talk Radio.
You're tuned in to 93 Sweet FM Zone. And you know it's the Los Angeles. Later. Sweet. You know, this is the only place that you can hear from the Funkadelic to the Temptations on 93 Sweet FM. And I'm your host with the most, the Rothschild, Mr. Bruce Rothschild. And you're tuned in again. Oh, I hear you asking where we've been, where we've been. All around the world, and we're going to do it again. We've got the famous Tweed Cadillac. On 93 Sweet FM is on.
All right, parents, go ahead and tuck the kids in. PG time is over. This goes out to all the Macs in the industry. All right, roll tech.
It's a good thing that we're rapping.
You ain't no pimp.
If it wasn't for the rapping,
your rap fans would be
macking.
It's a good thing that we're rapping. Cause if it wasn't for the rapping, we'd be macking. It's a good thing that we're rapping.
Your rap fans would be macking.
There was a time when they called me Smooth Eddie. Playing them holes and shook the red card fatty.
It was Mike, for those that know. Matter of fact, Icy Mike, cause he was cold on them hoes.
We was East Coast niggas heading west. I was rolling shotgun, cooling with my man Fresh West. The Royal Blue Brome was a drop top rag.
You could tell we was pimps from the Las Vegas tag.
On the cat,
cause that's how we flipped it. Hit a lick, paid cash, same night.
Pimp shit.
All of this was round spring 81. I was in the life and had a good 3-year run.
Anyway, one Friday on the side of the highway in L.A., my man West said,
hey, I got a bitch in San Diego.
I said, I'll see you in a couple of days. I'ma stay and play some L.A. hoes.
He said, all right, player, yo, I'll see you soon.
Yeah, that's how real players kick and see there ain't no rules. We roll from city to city like kids playing hooky. Later that night, I knock a bitch named Cookie. She says, I love you and I want to make you rich. I said, well, yeah, I swear I worked the shit out this bitch. She was fine, niggas couldn't tell me nothing. Had brains too, did more stealing than fucking. A real thoroughbred, played con like a pro. Man, I'm trying to tell you I had a money-making hoe. But the sunset track got stale. Cookie went to jail, I had to sling a little slum to make bail. She said, I'm hot, baby, I can't work in this town. The vice picked me up just as soon as you put me down. I said, shut the hell up, hoe, who asked you to run your mouth? She was right, so it was time to take the trip down south. To this very day, when I think of how I was living back then, I got to say that it's a good thing that I'm rapping. Cause if it wasn't for the rapping, I'd be macking. Good thing we got music. If not, we're stuck with finding a way to get ahead, and then we got to use it. It's a good thing that I'm rapping. Cause if it wasn't for the rapping, I'd be macking. Good thing we got music. If not, we're stuck with finding a way to get ahead, and then we got to use it. They call it ho-po when you're leaking. So you know that ho-po is when you're po' cause you got no hoe. I was po' but I wasn't ho-po cause I had one hoe. But we was leaking cause the money was slow. Cop and blow means you're going up and down. I went from Cadillac to Vegas to the back of Greyhound to San Diego.
On Broadway there used to be a spot, I think E Street and Fifth, while the players flocked.
One night I was cooling outside. Saw my man West, said, oh shit, yeah, it's gonna be live. I was working a double breast suit. My $500 brown knee-high ballies. West said it's pimpish how you wear them outside your pants. And by the way, my ham sandwich in the alley.
Ham sandwich meant pro-ham Cadillac. Quarter-inch whites with the chrome wheel kit on the back.
It was snotty nose.
That means the extra chrome plate on the grill. For sunroof, we say it had the brain blown.
I said, this bitch is inside. Yo, you ready to attack? West looked at me, said, Mac, 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 Mac. My man Tim Stroll was cold gangsta limping. We stepped inside, both of us screamed, it's pimping. I was drinking cognac, West was drinking gin. Wasn't there 20 minutes before my people walked in. I said, what's up, Cookie? How'd you do? She said, cool, reach under the bar so I can give you these feels. We always did it like that in case the Vice Squad was peeping. This time they wasn't, but this nigga who was leaking walked up and said,
y'all gon' cheer?
West said, nigga, don't you recognize the P when you see it?
He said, oh, yo, I didn't know. I thought she's doing business.
she's a hoe.
He said, "She with you, player, cause I really like to buck her."
Looked at her, said,
"Baby, I'm a raw motherfucker."
Said, "Yeah, that might be true, but she don't need another knucker. Ain't no choosing jumping off slick. This one here's my schnucker."
He said, "What you mean by schnucker?
It ain't that hard to figure. You call your nigga knucker, schnucker means she nigga. And figure this too, the bitch is down for my dirty drawers. Find another hoe to go for yours."
He said, "But I like her."
I said, "You must be a rookie. Now figure this three."
He cut me off and stepped the cookie, said,
"How do you feel about this, my dear?"
I said, "Nigga, you don't check my bitch like I ain't standing here. Now I told you that the woman sells pussy for me. You and her ain't the two, and we ain't the three. And most of all, nigga, I ain't the one. Now back the fuck up off me, son."
He said,
"To buck another man's game is a shame."
I said, "Leaking ass nigga, game recognized game. Now I told you that's my people and I gave you a chance." Reached down and started pulling up my tool from my pants. Should've capped his ass, but instead I look up and Western wrapped a pool stick around this nigga's head. So I put my shit away. We beat him down cowboy style. Cookie runs up and says, "Baby, you okay?" Yo, all of this excitement got you dizzy, but you stand around watching, bitch, get busy. Go back outside and finish getting my money. The boss and the last fish, you pimp niggas funny. And I'll tell you once again, it blows my mind when I think of how I was living back then. Cause yo, it's a good thing that I'm rapping. Cause if it wasn't for the rapping, I'd be backing. Good thing we got music. If I was stuck with finding a way to get ahead, and then we got to use it. It's a good thing that I'm rapping. Cause if it wasn't for the rapping, I'd be macking. Good thing we got music. If I was stuck with finding a way to get ahead, and then we got to use it. And y'all don't stop. Huffing, huffing the house. And yo, I go, do-de-o, go. Don't you do? Why must I tip the hoe? Nothing but the Mac in me.
Digital Underground joint. Y'all tune in to 93.3 FM-ism. What a beautiful episode it's going to be tonight, man. We got the co-founder live on the premises, Mr. Chop Master J. Speak on it.
What's up? What's up, people? What's up, family? Everything's beautiful, you know, and we're just appreciative to still be here and share with everyone.
Isn't that a beautiful thing? Just to be around. Yeah. A lot of us didn't make it today. A lot of us got up, woke up this morning, and didn't make it. So, man, you must always drop to your knees and stay pleased. And that's my motto. That's why I stay in the house. Y'all can go outside and keep my ass in the house. I keep my ass in the house. Been there, done that outside shit. I'm good.
That's right. That's real, though.
Man, once you get older and you've been there, seen it, done it, it ain't nothing in the streets for you but troubles, death, mayhem, robberies, fruit men selling you oranges. It ain't really nothing too much out there.
To be not real at all. With
you, it ain't too much out there in the streets, man. But anyway, man, once you lived a vainglorious life like yourself, man, you got a lot to talk about. You've been there, seen that, done that. I'm sure your ass should be inside right about now as well. First of all, you survived the Oakland streets, so that right there is commendable. A lot of people could not do that, cannot do that, and will not be able to do that. So that right there is a milestone in your life. So let's talk about it. Let's talk about it. You know something, man, that kind of intrigued me was the fact that I read your story. I understood what you've been through. I just didn't understand why it ended up the way it is. I can relate to your story and on various levels, but it always, man, it was like a burning question. But you know how they say, it's always, you know how they say that shit. It's three answers to the truth. No, it's two stories to the truth, or it's three stories to the truth. So, man, we're going to get to the truth. And I don't need you to lie to me. I need you to tell me everything the way it is. We got your back, your front, your side. I just don't want to, I want to know, how did it end up the way it ended up? G. Lou, man, are you there, man? Let me bring up my calls. G. Lou, are you there, sir? Okay,
yeah,
beautiful,
yeah.
Man.
Good evening, good evening, good evening.
Man, John Master J, he about to tell us the real story. But look, sir, let's take us back. Let's go all the way back. Because what I know about it, I want to make sure that I did my correct research. Now, let me break this shit down. It was your idea for Digital Underground. You and Shock G started it. Am I right or wrong before I keep going?
Absolutely right.
Okay. I also heard that your people put up some front money to even get it started. Am I right or wrong?
Right. Absolutely right.
Okay. I also heard that you brought Tupac to the table. Am I right or wrong?
Partially right.
Okay. I also heard that you wore many hats, from road manager to engineer to drummer to, you did a, you multitasked to make the group what it was. Am I right or wrong?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Did everything.
Well, what the
everything
hell
yeah.
What the hell happened, Chop? Break it on down for us, man. We need to know this. No disrespect to no members. Pac, Money B, everybody, man, we love Digital. That's why I had to play my favorite song, because I don't care. All them other songs y'all did, fuck Humpty Dance, yes, it was cool, but, man, that one right there, if it wasn't for the rapping, that's been my all-time favorite. And I don't want to say fuck Humpty Dance, because that shit was cool. That bass line was phenomenal. But, you know, yeah. I like some off-brand Digital songs, like No Nose Job and things of that nature, man. I like, man, the style, the style, man, that y'all had was, y'all actually could have did it without Shock even had to put on the nose. He didn't have to be humping, it still would have been fly. But anyway, man, take us back to the beginning. Man, take us back to the beginning. Break it down.
You know, I mean, for the most part, you're talking about the late, mid-80s, 1987. And you got to think about the era of hip-hop that was going on at that time. And you got to be able to have the ability historically to understand how hip-hop was 98% New York at that time. It really didn't exist as far as other people trying to compete on a recording record label type of thing. And predominantly, most of the hip-hop was at Def Jam, or at Profile, and or at certain other smaller companies in New York. So us being on the West Coast, where, you know, at that particular time, you had Short, who was selling his mixtapes off the back of the bus, and then just had started kind of coming out with his records, and eventually, I think, ended up over at RCA, somewhere like that. I believe that RCA would have did. And then a year and a half or so later, Hammer blew up. And Hammer was someone that was going around to the local nightclubs with a whole group of people and had the DJ put on his song, and they start dancing in the club. So he was promoting his shit at the club level while Short was producing his stuff on the street level, straight out like Street. Hammer was in the street too, but he was more at functions and clubs and things that had people already there. Shock and I plugged in because a lot of my friends at the time coming up in Oakland and in Berkeley at the time were recruited and joined the whole Sheila E. Prince thing that jumped off. Because all of my friends and associates are musicians. Shock and I approached Digital Underground as musicians, not as local neighborhood kids who rap together in a crew or a DJ doing this. We didn't even have a DJ. We would go to a kid's house who was a DJ and have him do some rubs and sample some of the stuff that he would do for us in terms of cuts and rubs and stuff, and then go back and fly them in the song. So we approach it. This thing is really more from a musician standpoint, and it really kind of and would have and could have stood on its own legs. And what you said was very much on point, that the novelty of what the Humpty Dance did and was cool in one sense. It's like a hit record can make and break you, not make or break you, but make and break you, because it broke us kind of apart from what we started out to be, which is some musicians making hip-hop. Shock would have stayed behind the piano and just rapped, and I'd have been rocking them drums, and we'd have probably brought in a DJ, and you know, but it would have been more along the lines of the Roots versus the idea of, and what I mean by that, just meaning we still make cool, the subject matter would be cool, themes would be cool, but the production would have probably still been kind of that, but our live show and our whole thing would have been more where it was around us being musicians and having a following from doing that versus the hit record that kind of makes you come and go. It's like a novelty. And you got to know, too, back then, the idea was it was still about crossing over. It was black music, and then it was crossover pop. And so back then, at the end of the day, the Humpty Dance and the Nose and the whole shit was novelty crossover pop. And that made it to where, you know, that stuff's going to be short-lived. You know, I mean, when you think about novelty songs, you could very easily end up being like, I'm too white, but I'm too sexy for my shirt type shit. And that can be a problem. So, like I said,
Disco Duck.
You know what I'm saying? I mean, you know, and all that. Plus, you do... Excuse me, once again, you got to remember the idea of where hip-hop was at that time, and it was anti-crossover, it was anti-pop. The New York cats, they wanted to cross over and be pop, and they did it, and they all blew up with that. All the back east folks, whether Will Smith out of Philly, or LL of New York, or even Latifah out of New York, and everybody about New York, they crossed over and did their thing and made it happen, whether in records, TV, or film. But the idea with us was, like I said, this was a musician thing, and the one of them cats that's in the group that's a musician, meaning Shock, was, he liked the idea of us jumping into the rap world and doing more rap because he felt as though rap was the newest music on the planet. And a lot of the other people that were, you know, we could have easily been on some Tony type shit, or meaning some R&B or some R&B funk or just straight funk. But the idea of putting some rap over some funk was going to make it the next thing. And being up out of Oakland, being up out the town, being up out the Bay Area is known for innovation. We really do and still do create most of the stuff that the country and the world emulates. And, you know, so and it gets deep
is,
like that.
Was that just, I mean, for the character Hump, he just made that up one day, said, man, I'm going to get this nose, put on these fly-ass hats.
No, it wasn't contrived like that, no. It really
because
wasn't.
I was thinking that it was a plan, because if it was, well, from my analytical type thinking, I'm like, what a great idea, because the best way to separate yourself from any other group or organization is to be totally different. So I could see if y'all would have walked up into a label with him in character, that would have been so fucking fly. So they were like, man, this is the hottest thing. They could have saw the vision. And once they heard the music, it was like, wow. And then the cool thing about it as well, Humpty was on some player shit. Because if it wasn't for the rapping, I mean, that was, man, the first time I heard that song, we went crazy. We went crazy. So I'm like, man, from a marketing standpoint, it seemed like it was just a complete great idea. And to be funk-based as well, wow. So the ball started bouncing. Everything is good. Then what happened? Let's pick it up from there.
Well, you know, for the most part, the idea was to, like I said, for us to do what we was doing. And to pick it up from there, what starts happening is so many times when your talent and your energy and efforts, when they reap reward and when shit starts to happen for you, there is a time that comes in there that, you know, when you start, when your reality starts to match your dreams, or when they start to exceed your dreams, you end up feeling undeserving and you start to relinquish the idea of pushing forward, or you don't know how to deal with that aspect of it. And I mean that as a group and as management and as everything goes, a lot of things happen. That shit happened real fast. And so that's another thing, a hit record happening when you're not really prepared at the end of the day can end it for you, because all the opportunities come and you don't realize it. And I'm sure that as a group and what we did, we pushed away more opportunities than a lot of people will ever get. And that was truly true, the idea of having a hit and then resenting the fame from that hit. And a lot of times that happened. Plus, again, put it in context with the era and what I'm talking about in terms of hip-hop. You want to have some success, but you ain't trying to be seen as a sellout. And so, you know, and like Ice Cube said, shit, he said, I didn't sell out. He said, they just bought in.
That's a good one. I like that.
Yeah, you know, and so, and because I came from jazz and jazz fusion as a drummer and a musician, all of my heroes were these jazz fusion dudes, Stanley Clark, Chick Corea, Lenny White, George Duke, the Weather Report, all them kind of fusion bands. And so when you come from that as a person, my thing was, is like, if you ever noticed, you know the song Peanut Butter? You know
yes,
that song,
sir,
Peanut
Lenny
Butter?
White, featuring
okay,
29,
so,
preaching to
okay,
the choir,
keep
on.
Okay, cool. So, you know, so the idea of it all, I'm glad, I'm happy, because the whole idea of it all, when you understand that, they would make a song like that, and then they would go back to their true shit. That wasn't their whole album. The whole album wasn't Peanut Butter, right? The album actually would be go back to some more jazz fusion, and the focus would be on musicianship. But they would make a novelty hit. They would try to make a novelty or a pop hit, and that's where I was coming from with going in and making the Humpty Dance, or going in and making Do What You Like, and things of that nature. It was like, yeah, we want to have some shit that's popular, but we want to make it popular so they accept our real shit, which is just musicianship. But,
right.
You know, that's
almost
that,
like
that
the
popularity.
Group pleasure. Almost like the group
I love
pleasure.
Pleasure, man. See?
And me
yeah,
too,
see?
Man. Me too, man. Man, we are one alike, man. We're going to have to chop it up after this show and talk some music shit, because I'm on the same page you are, sir. But look, though.
Okay.
As far as that bass line for Humpty Dance,
yeah.
Just the sound of it was, you know how they say simplicity is really what you need? You don't have to be all that intricate. It's the sonics and the sound of it. That right there just killed it. Everything else was fell in place, but that bass just drove the hell out that song. And, man, you're talking about a well-put-together song. That was a well-put-together song. I can imagine the recording process. After you guys finished that song, did you sit back and say, It's just my work. What did y'all say?
Well, that song, Tweet, that song was created out of desperation. And the reason being that we turned in the whole Sex Package album to Tommy Boy, and Tommy Boy pulled the oldest trick in the book that they do with artists, up-and-coming artists, and I was like, yeah, it sounds really good, but we don't hear the hit. So, like, they didn't hear Freaks of the Industry. They didn't hear, you know, some of the other songs on the album. They said, we don't hear the hit. And so with that in mind, it's a situation that you tell that to artists, and then they rush in there and go make all kind of shit to try to make that hit, because they tell you they don't hear the hit, and not only do they not hear the hit, your album is going to get bumped 3 months or 6 months down the road before they put it out, which, you know, so this, when we were making Humpty Dance, we were making that shit, we actually kind of got in an argument at the time, and the bass started looping in the way that it did. It actually kind of was a blessing and an accident, because, like I said, we started arguing, but then we were like, because the shit was locked, and we were arguing about what we were doing. And lo and behold, we look up, and that shit was like, it's what you hear. And so we were like, damn. So we had to stop arguing. We had to stop arguing, like what you were saying, how we felt after the song was done. Now, we kind of felt that way once that bass locked up like that and looped, and we're like, oh, shit. And so, you know, the real deal is that song was made because if we didn't make a song that felt like a hit, it was going to get bumped, and the album was going to get bumped. So the song was made out of desperation. It had to happen.
So when they heard the song, did they automatically think it was a hit still?
Hell yeah. Didn't you?
Okay. Yeah, I was just saying, how did they feel?
I'm just clowning.
Sometimes record labels don't know what a hit is, though. Just like you
said.
They never do. They'll
but then the last
the
thing, like,
song.
All the time.
Yeah.
All the time. But they're, you know, that particular song, the bass and the sonics of the bass and what it was doing was actually the star of the song. And then the only thing that could even outdo it was the clowning braggadocio rap shit on top that Hump put down. So,
and it was,
you know, you know, but the bass is the star of the song. The bass, the Sly Stone loop up under it, and the claps. I can't think. I'm sorry, I'm cursing. Can you curse on here?
Things
from the Black Hole. So the clap from Things from the Black Hole, and the bass line and the loop up under that shit. But up under that shit, you know what I'm saying? No. But then that is from Sly and the Family Stone. So too, sitting up in there, he was talking about the Let's Play House with George Clinton, which is that shit, you know. But anyway, the bottom line is the song, it was all put together. It was dope. We did that shit at our band house. Also, when we were getting the mix done on that when you see and you hear about Tupac, when it comes to Tupac came along because his manager at the time, Leva Steinberg, wanted us to work with her group Strictly Dope. And she sent Tupac over to Starlight Studios in Richmond where we were mixing the Humpty Dance. And because Tommy Boy had recently just said that we're going to bump y'all record if we don't get a hit. So when Tupac came through, that's why, he auditioned. Shock was like, yeah, you tight, you cool, but I can't fuck with you right now. And Tupac was crushed. He was hurt. And, you know, and all the rest of that stuff. And so at that time, the management, Layla, the management, Layla was someone who, I jumped in the story because you did ask about Pac and what I, and how I got with Pac and how I introduced, did what I did, but I'm saying that ultimately our manager at the time, Adrian Gregory, used to manage J.J. Fad, or road manager, was the road manager for J.J. Fad, Supersonic, right? On Ruthless Records, right? And, you know, at that particular point, he would go to this nightclub, a teenage nightclub up in Santa Rosa, where J.J. Fad would perform. The lady who booked the club, name was Layla Steinberg, who ran a community center in, up in Santa Rosa, that had all kind of kids coming and participating, and Tupac was one of them. And they had a little group called Strictly Dope, and she connected Strictly Dope with our manager at the time, and Shock turned down working with Tupac at that time, and so they turned and they asked me to go in the studio and do it. And so I went and go and cut some tracks on Strictly Dope, and in the process of cutting those tracks on it, built a rapport with Tupac and built a bond with him before anybody else in the group had. And ultimately, the way that Tupac ended up being in the group was he quit Strictly Dope and just popped up at our doorstep and was there, and he knew what he was doing because at the end of the day, he had a taste of that energy by hanging out around me when I'm cutting their demos. He felt their energy and knew that he could break out. So he broke out, right. And they said, you know, at the end of the day, if you want, I wanted a roadie to help me with my shit because I played samplers and percussion, live percussion during our shows. And that's what I did. So I actually had gear that needed to be set up. And so, you know, he wanted to be a part of, I needed a roadie. Shock wanted a dancer on the other side of Money B, so it looked like the Humpty Dance video when we performed it live. Plus, another kind of backup MC, because once again, it was only Shock and I, but the idea and the concept of Digital Underground was to be more like Ultra Magnetic MC and shit, like a bunch of people, or Sex and Sonics. It was about being a crew, you know what I'm saying? But we didn't have a crew,
right?
So we just made it up, and we created the illusion of having a crew, and that's what it was really all about. That's why a lot of times you'll see pictures of people that are called Digital Underground, that are just there, and we wanted to make it look like it was more than just who was, and put them in, like, extras.
Wow.
And
I always thought I always thought Digital was a big, big, like, band, because all the people in the pictures.
Right, exactly. And so, you know, the whole thing was an illusion. Let me tell you something. When I met Shaq, you loved the whole idea of, you lucky I'm rapping because I would be macking. Because when I met Shaq, he was a down on his luck grifter, ex pimp, kind of posing as a keyboard salesman at Music Unlimited in San Leandro, which is where I met him buying some equipment. So I met this dude who was a down on his luck hustler that was trying to get his life together, working at a music store because that was the one passion he had that was cool as an artist. He was a piano player, but he also really more than anything else was a technical wizard, like MIDI and the production style of the technology of what was happening, and his musicianship, because his musicianship wasn't masterful like the kind of stuff I came up playing and stuff. You know, his musicianship was kind of top 40 band type quality musicianship, play parts and stuff. But with the technology, a lot of motherfuckers seem like Mozart. You know what I'm saying? And so, you know, and I'm not taking nothing away from it, because you still got to be dope to take the stuff and utilize it to enhance you, right? The technology is meant to enhance what you do. It's meant to enhance what you do. It's not meant to become all of what the technology is. It's meant to take the technology and make your shit dope. So the idea is that, you know, the idea is that with songs like the Humpty Dance, with my relationship with Shock and he and I coming together as a band and and two musicians to make a hip hop band, which is what it was about. The whole idea of Tupac taking it upon himself and being a highly motivated individual and come along and get in where he fit in. I tell so many people, Tweed, that the whole idea of Pac being of, you know, people and people that have had success in this business and people that are on the come up. And people that are on the come up is all, are always telling people that are in a mix or that, or that can create opportunities, hey, man, you should put me on, man. I can make you rich. I can do this. And the whole thing about it is like, you know, you hear that all the time, but Tupac did come and say, hey, man, Jay, what can I do to help so that I can be put on? And that is the difference. That was the magic word. So when you fuck with somebody, because when you're pursuing this stuff, everybody got that dream. Everybody's saying all this shit, but what are they willing to do for it? You know what I'm saying? I mean,
what you bring to the table. Exactly.
Right. And not, you know, and a lot of times people, I tell people that story because it's kind of an old thing, like learn to make yourself of service to somebody that you want something from. You know, like, you know, don't just go there asking for something, you know, like it's almost, shit, it's like dealing with anything else. It's like dealing with the higher powers and everything else that you got in your life. You got to show you want it and that you, you know, that you, you understand and you appreciate it. And when you do that, the doors open up for you in life. It's real simple.
Exactly. Right. He got in where he could fit in, not pretend in. And that's a beautiful situation because he benefited fully. I got a question for you, though, Chop. Which was a bigger hit, Do What You Like or Humpty Dance?
Humpty Dance sold over. Humpty Dance sold over. Humpty Dance is on record as being one of the fastest selling records to platinum in the history of the recording business. Back in them days, put it like this, the Humpty Dance, the only thing that beat the Humpty Dance to selling a million copies was White Christmas by Bing Crosby, We Are the World by Quincy Jones, and Ashley Tone Loc's Wild Thing.
Wow.
Yeah. Now that was at that time.
But like you said, Tweed, Do What You Like was my favorite though. That was my shit.
Thank you.
That's my favorite.
Well, thank you, because that's a lot more of my person. That's a lot more of my personality in that record. But the idea of that was that's what we got a single deal with Tommy Boy with that song.
I remember I had the Backstreet single.
Right.
On cassette. Yep.
Okay. Well, the idea of it all is that, oh, yeah, Do What You Like, right, and Hip Hop Doll was on the back.
Yep.
So how did the label start treating Doll after that? How did the label change up on you after that? Because now they're making money. Y'all out there.
Wait a minute now. The one thing about Tommy Boy, because I knew that they were on the record. What was that? What was that? A gunshot. The idea of it all is that with Tommy Boy was, because I know that in the recent, they had bad press with dealing with De La Soul and all the rest of that stuff. But you got to know that.
They had a bad experience with Tommy Boy. I didn't hear a lot of good things about Tommy Boy.
So did Coolio, and a lot of people did.
Let me say this to you, that my experience with them was, because first of all, at that time, we were the only West Coast rap group to get signed by an East Coast label. That hadn't happened. All right? So for me, it was like creating a vision and seeing somebody, they got it. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, they got it, you know, at the time. They got the vision part. Now, they were, like, the major or one of the major international dance hip-hop labels in the world. So you could be, like, Tommy Boy can blow your ass up in Germany and can blow you up in France and over in other parts of the world because their brand was big. Their brand was the brand. It's kind of like the way that we ended up becoming caught up in brands or production companies or label names. Like there's a lot of things that would sell because it was on Bad Boy, whether you knew the artist or not. You know what I'm saying? It was just that it was a bad boy artist, so you would check it out or whatever. That's what Tommy Boy was back then. And so through African Bambaataa and Soul Sounding Force, who blew them up, that's who blew up Tommy Boy. All those Soul Sounding and all that club dance shit is what
Hell
Tommy
yeah.
Boy really was.
Hell
yeah.
Yeah. If you notice, their logo was the B-Boys spinning
right.
on their head.
Yep, yep, yep.
But,
right,
you know,
right,
it was
right,
the
right.
place
Still
to be
was.
If you was with it. So,
right, so it was, you know.
What about the checks? Did the checks clear? Was they
you
trying
know, you,
to
show you know
Charles on the bread?
You know, for the most part, you know, initially the checks were good, you know. But I got to tell you, when it comes to all this business aspect of the business acumen and all the rest of that, what starts to happen is the intangibles that happen. See, what happens is, in addition to people being talented and having the art and this and the audience and all that, then it gets to be within your camp. Who's in your camp that's currying good favor and building relationships with people and people want to fuck with you, not just because you're a success, but because you're actually likable, too. There's something about you, the cross. You know what I'm talking about. You guys have that in relationships and stuff. There are people that you encounter that's cool and you do some business with. Then there's some that, you know, that might make you feel good, too. And it's like, I want to do business with them. I like them. It's like, and at the time, I was kind of like that with a Tommy Boy because I knew and I saw that that's what they were. And then, but then I also saw that a large part of it was currying good favor with them, being likable, being this, that, and the other. What happened with Digital Underground, a large part of it was the idea was the management was ill prepared, even though, let me give you a little background on that. So in 1988, I gone and started working as a production assistant down in L.A., with my boy Daryl Ross. I grew up in Berkeley, and in the early 1970s, there was a jazz music program that was happening at the public schools in Berkeley. And it was, and because of it, you would end up being in this jazz band in the fourth grade. After school, from the fourth grade all the way through high school, you were in this jazz program taught by this man, Phil Harding. The superintendent of our school was the program director of K-Jazz Radio in San Francisco Bay Area. So our superintendent of all of our schools in Berkeley was the program director for K-Jazz, and he fired up a jazz music program in his district, in his thing, and so he would bring people like Duke Ellington, Donald Byrd, people like that would come play and sit in with us in class. And then they would do a performance that night at the 3,000-seat Berkeley Community Theater, and we'd be these little kids performing with Duke Ellington, with Donald Byrd, with Dick Gregory. We did all kinds of, we opened up for Dick Gregory, stuff like that. So that whole thing was happening. Now, there was a star that was kind of born out of that thing. There's lots of dope musicians who are all in the mix that you've been hearing for years, but one of them was a cat named Rodney Franklin. And do you know Rodney Franklin, please? Hello?
Tweet.
So Rodney. Yeah. Rodney.
Yes,
Rodney.
I know
was,
Rodney Franklin. I know
okay,
Rodney
so,
Franklin. A great keyboardist.
So,
yes.
Yes. And so Rodney is a guy who I've been knowing since I was 5 years old. And Rodney is somebody who I call when I was shopping Shock and I's demo, Your Life's a Cartoon, which is a Pink Panther cover talking about how speaking from being disenfranchised and speaking truth to power, kind of a song, more Public Enemy and BDP than anything else. And so the idea of it all is that Rodney really dug it, and Rodney told me that I'm right on time because he and his partner, his friend, just started a production company, and this, that, and the other, and that his buddy is being mentored right now by the biggest guys in the business. And he's like, oh, okay, but he never told me who or what. And so Shock and I were to sign this deal with Golden Eagle Productions, which was Rodney and Atron's company, Atron Gregory. And Atron, lo and behold, but I found out later, he was being mentored and the situation was happening where he was A-Train was tour manager for NWA, and like I told you, he was road manager for JJ Fad initially. He also was tour manager for NWA, and so he's being mentored by Jerry Heller. And we all know what that story turned out to be later, right?
Indeed.
About Jerry Heller, NWA, and folks of that nature. And I don't know if any of that should be true, but what's been implied and what's been said is that Jerry Heller would play one against the other and, you know, lock himself in with one and tell them to screw everybody else. Like Jerry got with Easy, and then Easy and Jerry worked to alienate.
That's Tweed's guy. Tweed knows. Look, Tweed, what
okay.
do you think about Jerry? Tweed has a good opinion.
I was signed to Ruthless Records. I don't know if you know about.
Okay,
me.
So you know. Adrian.
I'm not just a radio host. I was an artist back in 1992 with the
okay.
Penthouse Players Clique. I know JJ.
Oh, hell yeah.
I'm Tweed Cadillac, baby. That's me.
You know what? I'm sorry, bro. I'm no disrespect. I'm bugging. We've been going through a bunch of stuff, and when we got down with y'all to do this, I was bugging. I'm sorry. But the bottom line is, so then you know it. And
yes,
you know the situation.
Yes, sir.
And I don't, and so I'm just saying from my side and speaking where I'm not trying to be in a way where I'm saying anything, where I'm saying things were alleged.
Man, speak your piece, man. You don't need no disclaimer.
Right, so
tell it from your point.
Right. Well, you know, hey, you know, I hear you, but at the end of the day, so A-Tron was being mentored by Jerry. And lo and behold, it really just, as I learned more and more and more about how that shit went and how the public learned more and more and more, I realized that that had been done to me. And that had been done to me with A-Train because what basically ended up happening was this, is that so A-Train and Rodney had a production company called Golden Eagle Productions. We had a bunch of different meetings and shit down here in L.A. over at different little places, cute little restaurants and shit. We met just me, him, and Rodney, A-Train, Rodney, and myself. Shock was working at the music store for Stanley Andrew. I was the only one down here. And the real deal was is that when it came time to sign the deal, Tweed, it was called Golden Eagle Productions Roman Numeral 2. And Rodney wasn't involved at all. And I didn't know. We did not know this. I wasn't really tripping. It said Golden Eagle Productions. It had a Roman Numeral 2 behind it. But I didn't know that that was any different than the company that he and Rodney had fired up together. So the first part is, to me, that's some fraudulent shit to pull. Then secondly, the real deal is all of the work that needed to be done to create a buzz for Tommy Boy to want to sign us is the work that I had done with Shock and the work that we had done by me going around all college and alternative radio, things of that nature, and going in and working this. And doing it that way. So by the time that we even looked to sign this deal with Rodney Nature, we had all, like the bottom line, they just kind of just stepped in shit and came up smelling like rose. They hadn't done anything. And A-Train, even more so, had just kind of stolen this group from his boy Rodney, period. You know, and Rodney still had his own career. He was doing his own thing. And even after his own thing wasn't as much in demand, he was on tour with Stevie Wonder for 9 years as keyboard player. And with the Ozzy Brothers for another 8 or 9 years. So, you know, he was working and doing his thing. And A-Train and him, I don't know how Rodney allowed A-Train to do this without challenging him about money, but the real deal is that it was kind of wrong and stuff in what happened and how this happened, and it didn't expose itself till later. So the situation with DU really honestly was, other than Shock and I initially, but the whole business part of it was founded on a faulty foundation, which means it's going to crumble. You can't build something being, you know, shady off the bottom like that. I mean, goddamn. And so, you know, but we had good spirits and good energy about what we were trying to achieve as a group. and then some niggas making some music, and that's what we were doing. Like I said, the business aspect of it didn't expose itself till later, because it wasn't like we talked to Rodney all the time anyway. Rodney was a working dude doing his own thing. So we understood that Atrium was more the administrative cat, and he's more the day-to-day of the guy you'd be talking to time to time. So, and even him, he was busy out touring with NWA and tour managing and shit. So all the stuff that was going on, I was doing all the work like I had been doing, hitting all college and alternative radio, doing all this different stuff. And, you know, what ended up happening too, and what people saw was that they associated me as this cat doing all this stuff. And so the whole, and we're going to get to that Humpty part too, because the whole personality, the character thing is like, you know how you be with folks in your crew tweet and external folks, and people be influencing and inspiring you and influencing you with different stuff, and you incorporate that into your persona or who you are, or even sometimes just some lyrics some motherfucker said, whatever.
Yeah.
The bottom line is my father, the man who gave us money to begin with, Mr. Wonderful. That's what we call him. I'm Jimmy Dry Jr. He's Jimmy Dry Sr. And my pops is a street legend in Oakland and in the Bay Area, and from being all kinds of people. But we'll just say for right now, the bottom line is he gave us some money for us to go do our thing. And he's a jazz musician as well. And a lot of the stuff, you said Pleasure, that's a group that was signed to Fantasy Records, and Fantasy Studios is in Berkeley. And when I got with Shock too, the very first thing with Shock would get off work at Music Unlimited up in San Leandro, and he would catch the bus to the rehearsal spot that I was doing rehearsal stuff with my father for the Mr. Wonderful albums we were going to record, which we recorded at Fantasy Studios in Berkeley, Tweed, which is real fly, dope, you know, one of them $2,500 a day studios. And you know, and Shock would catch the bus and come sit in on those sessions when we were doing that. Shock also sought out, and he saw that, you know, that I looked to be all right and had money and affluent and all, but I wasn't affluent and all that. My dad was large on a lot of levels, and I had a lot of love and support and all the rest of that. And so, you know, the real deal is that when we got to doing this business with Atrium and Rodney, but then there's no Rodney and there's only Atrium, it just got to be kind of weird. And then what started happening was we had the hit and we had the success. And so there'll be people, when those things happen in group environments, you know, some people don't want to adhere to the deal. Some people don't want to honor the deal. Some people feel like, oh, well, you know, I'm here now. We're here now. We don't need this. We don't need everybody now. You know what I'm saying?
Wow.
And
Rodney
also,
ever switch up on you? Not to cut you off, did Rodney Franklin ever switch up on you?
No, Rodney never switched up. I mean, what happened was Atrium switched up on Rodney. You know what I'm saying? Rodney's my boy to this day. Atrium
still around.
Is the
Rodney's
guy.
Still around. The groove,
yeah.
Rodney Franklin is still around.
Rodney's up in the Bay. Yep, he surely is.
Wow. Well, you need to get him up, man. We would love. We've interviewed over 85% of all TV1 unsung artists. I would love to get Rodney on this platform. That would be great. I would love to get Pleasure, because my favorite Pleasure song ain't Glide. G. Lou love Glide. But I love
yeah.
Now You Choose Me. And I love
yes,
Thinking
yes.
of My Old Flame. That's my shit
yes.
right there. Oh, my
I love Special Things. I love Special Things. I love Law of the Raw. Hell yeah. Let me tell you something, man.
Glide, the mix on Glide is so fucking fly, though. We used to ride around on that song all day long in the car and pull up on somebody playing Glide. That's it, man. You was the shit if you could pull up with some sounds on that
yeah,
one.
Pull up with some sounds. Pull up with that shit bumping, right?
Oh, my
I,
God.
I'm telling my son, like, they don't understand. That's how we used to knock chicks and all that back then. You'd be pulling that
exactly.
shit sound good as loud.
They do not understand. And the mix on Glide to this day, if you listen to the mix on Glide, this is 2021. That shit is still flawless. And in hell, it's just the time. Man, oh
yep.
Man. Hey, funny part about it, spoke on Santa Rosa. That's where I live right now. I'm originally from L.A., but I live in Santa Rosa. So I'm like a hop, skip, and a jump away from you. A bridge, and I'm at your front door with some yak. Believe me.
There it is. You know, I'm down here in L.A.
Oh, I thought you was still in the Bay.
No, I ain't up in the Bay right now. No, I'm down here in Woodland Hill.
Oh, okay. Keep it pimping. Keep it pimping.
You know,
hey, man, what I want to say as well, did Atron get some money out of y'all and kept it moving too?
Oh, making money to this day. And,
wow.
And you know, Atron basically put it like this. Shock and I are 50-50 partners on Digital Underground. All right? We're 50-50 partners. So, and that's because Shock and I have been through a few different situations trying to sign a deal. And, you know, and so the whole idea of it is that we signed a deal once before with Reggie Jackson's older brother, James Jackson, Reggie Jackson, the baseball player. And that didn't work out. We signed a deal with this one cat, George Murphy.
I know George Murphy. I've been in the game.
Okay.
He had a real motherfucker, studio.
A Pico, right?
Yes, sir. I've been in there. Man, wow. The world is small, player.
Shock and I were in there in like 87, 88, in 88. The very beginning of 88.
And that's when we was in there. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And that deal didn't work out, right? When we both signed and shit, and that didn't work out either. So then we had the idea, or Shy had the idea, that tell you what, on the next deal, just one of us will sign it. So if it don't work out, the other one can be free to go sign the deal. And I'm like, bet. That's cool with me. That worked. So basically, I signed Shock to Atron and to Golden Eagle Productions. All right? Because he and I had a 50-50 deal. And so Atron is to honor the 50-50 deal. Now, what happens with Atron is, Atron looks up now and is like, well, wait a minute. I'm signing something that's only 50% there. So worst case, best case in there, because he's trying to sign when the production deals, right, they give you 50%, right? He's like, he's the production company. He's 50-50 with us. And then he goes and goes striking some kind of imprint deal somewhere. So at the end of the day, when he looks up, he's only got 25%. He's only got 25%. Shock got 25%, and I got 50%. You understand? So those numbers didn't jive right for Atron. And so for him, he was constantly pulling the kind of shit that you hear Jerry Heller doing with me, trying to weasel me out of the situation.
Right.
And so, and in that process, he's been perpetuating this false narrative that Shock and I don't like each other, or this, that, and the other. And it wasn't that. He would go and say all kind of wild shit and do shit to create this animosity between Shock. And then don't get me wrong, like, you know, being in groups and stuff, cats get to tripping sometimes, get to flashing on the other cats in the group. There are those times when egos kick in, right? When, you know, when you try to edge God out, and you end up making some real bad decisions based on some bullshit. So,
I said, been there, done that. I'm listening.
Exactly. So, let's go back a little bit to Mr. Wonderful. Mr. Wonderful, my father, Mr. Wonderful, was the kingpin of Oakland in the 60s and 70s. the hairline cocaine kingpin of the shit from the 60s and 70s. I grew up a very privileged life up in the Bay, in Oakland, and all the rest of that stuff. And my father was killing me. I never saw my father buy anything off the rack my entire life. And he was all telling me, very, very, very confident, very much bravado, you know, the guy who controls, sucks the air out the room. And with Shock's experience hanging out, my father embraced Shock, let Shock hang out and stuff with me and all that kind of stuff at his house down here in Ladera Heights. So we'd be around some of that shit and this, that, and the other. And, you know, and my father would give up helpful hints, like, you know, when you're on that stage, see, you got to get you a towel, and you got to look like you're working real hard up there, like Frank Sinatra, and you got to put that towel across your face with it, and look like you're working real hard up there. So the next time when you watch the Humpty Dance video, you'll see that with Shock. You'll see that really, the honest to God's truth, you know, what happened ultimately is Shock took the influences that was around him, being my father and myself, by being the shit-talking, loud, fun-loving niggas that pay for everything type shit. And he took that persona because Shock was a much more chill dude, a much more low-key dude. He was more slick than all the rest of that shit. You know, he's real smart. He's really, really, quite honestly, teetered up on really nerdy. You know what I'm saying? But had an affinity for street shit. And so if you match a nerdy motherfucker with the street shit, sometimes you get some brilliant and some smart shit, or you just get, you know, whatever. But the bottom line is that my dad's persona is, a lot of that is Humpty Hump. A lot of it is Humpty Hump. And what ended up basically ultimately happening, you know, other than looking funny, because my father didn't look funny, but the real deal is, but the idea of it all is that the Humpty Hump character was something Shock did and then quickly resented. And he resented it so to the point where there were times he didn't even want to go and stay. He was crying. He didn't want to do it. Shit like that. A lot of people don't know. And it's almost kind of like, and I hate saying it because I was saying this before he passed, but the idea was, it was like the character grew bigger than him. He resented the character. And ultimately, but that's all anybody really identified him as. You know what I'm saying?
Exactly.
I mean, the real people did not want to do it no more. And let me say this to you too, Shock, because Shock was real smart, but Shock also was kind of arrogant too. Kind of had this back east and just kind of like this just basically kind of an arrogance about him. And my father and myself, but my father is one of the Southern brothers. You know what I'm saying? He didn't speak Southern sounding, but I'm just saying his persona is very over the top, very flamboyant, this, that, and the other. And Shock is someone who kind of resents those Negroes. You know what I'm saying? You know, like, you know, they're niggas. You know, like, they're niggas to him. So, end of the day, that's why it kind of came off as buffoonery on his part. Now, what ended up happening was, you know, the only thing that had some saving grace to it, like you said, was the street acumen of it, the pimping and this, that, and the other that worked for other things. But I'm telling you that character was a character that he did out of almost like kind of clowning my father. I mean, my father just kind of like clowning. It was kind of like a joke that turned into a character because we went and shopped for some costume stuff to do a photo shoot. And so we went and got a bunch of party stuff. And he came home and he put on that nose and glasses, and he was kind of clowning, like more like my pop, talking all crazy and shit and doing that stuff. And that character grew like that. So he really was kind of like mocking my pop, but in a fun way, to the point where it blew up. But then the very thing that he kind of clowned and mocked is what people became to love. And that's all they really liked. And then the other part of it is that, like, I can shoot you photos and I can show you in our upcoming documentary and all the rest of that, but just even my personality and my clothes, the shit that I would wear, the wild shit I would do, it made him have to try to feel like he had to outdo some of that. You know, when you're in a group, some things you start competing within each other, and I wasn't competing with nothing. I was completely prepared to be a star on stage. I practiced that. I practiced being famous more than anything, you know, along with my drugs. But I practiced being famous. I wasn't, you know what I'm saying, period, because I could have easily went and played, you know, three-quarter time jazz. I could have been somewhere in the world right now playing standard jazz stuff with jazz people, you know.
You could have been a Blackbird. You could have been a Blackbird.
All that, you know what I'm saying? I mean, like, put it like this. Rodney Franklin was the star that got signed to Columbia Records, but all of my other friends were, you know, like, a lot of us, because when I'm telling you, this music program started in, like, 1969, 1970. So, like, from 1970, I'm a kid in the second grade in 1970, and so I'm being bused to these white schools. Now, these white schools, I'll put it like this, a majority of my friends that come from the music program, I mean, are all the famous white European Jewish kids that are in jazz. My best friend, Benny Green, growing up. Peter Applebaum, Steven Bernstein. All these dudes are in New York, been working since we got out of high school in 82. They've been working, traveling the world, playing with the biggest jazz artists in the world. My best friend, Benny, grew up playing with Oscar Peterson, gave him a bracelet, passing him the torch. Benny was in Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers with Betty Carter. And that's the same caliber and level of people that I would be playing with if I decided to have pursued that. I decided to pursue hip-hop as a way, and I was able to achieve, you know, and was able to work and achieve with another cat and have a major pop success. So I know that I can achieve. But the bottom line is that with Shock, like Flip Wilson said, when Geraldine becomes bigger than Flip Wilson, he's going to stop doing Geraldine. And that's kind of what happened with Shock. Humpty became bigger than Shock, and Shock resented him. So, and ultimately, I really feel like it played a large part in killing him, because, you know, that's kind of hard.
You can never get over it. You can never really get over it.
Exactly.
It's like,
and all people
Herman. Like P.B. Herman.
Exactly.
Look how he went out. Became the most wholesome guy in the world, and he went out, but... Because he was not Pee-wee Herman. He was not Pee-wee Herman. You know, like, wow.
But Paul Root, to Pee-wee, Paul Root, he's still alive. He's still, well, I just seen him and stuff just recently. But I hear what you say. You're absolutely right. You're absolutely, the longevity. The bottom line is, with Shock, he became really kind of a prisoner of the character that he made famous. And it's really sad because, like I said, and going back to Tommy Boy, Tommy Boy was like, at that time, they were into the idea. Because let me tell you this. Let me tell you the hustle and the con of it all. Let me give you the game of what happened. Because this is what the movie and the story going to be. So at the end of the day, I meet this down on the luck grifter posing as a keyboard salesman in Music Unlimited. We get along together and we do a thing and create a group that is to seem like a big crew of musicians and rappers and people and all that, but it ain't none of that. It's two niggas. All right, so then we go on ahead, and I really hate is the thing, Tweed, that Shock actually played me, and the whole shit was the kind. When you go back to my man that's on the phone with Sid, when you go back to the idea of back of the Do What You Like album cover, the hip hop doll. When you look and you look at the credits again, you'll look to see that is Shock sketching out a scene from his favorite movie, The Sting Part 2. The Sting Part 2 is with Jackie Gleason, right? Trevor Plantagenet. And it's a real stupid movie about some con and all that stuff, but that's what that covers. And you'll look in the back and you'll even see this produced by Trevor Plantagenet and all this shit. So Shock was really into con and hustle. He wasn't into no overt shit. He was into outthinking you. So at the end of the day, I go with him, and I get assigned and present us as a group to a production company. The production company thinks it's a group, but then, lo and behold, they end up seeing that only one person signed. So Atrium was kind of mad with me that I didn't sign with him, and I only signed Shock to him. But then we go on ahead, and we continue on the concept of Digital Underground, and we take it, and Tommy Boy offers us a deal. We go over, and we do that deal. Now we've conned Tommy Boy that this is a group as well, where there's only one motherfucker that signed. And what they end up doing, they get pissed when they find out later because they've been paying for all kind of promotional stuff, and when they're paying, it's me, it's Money B, it's Fuse, and eventually Tupac. But they're paying for everything, and you know normally they're only going to pay for the sign dude and the production company, whatever, would have to pay for all that other shit. So that ain't what happened. And it was because they believed they had us all signed. They didn't know. They hadn't discussed with business affairs where that how it actually went down, I guess. So the bottom line is, but then once they find out, they were pissed because they'd been paying for all this other shit. But lo and behold, even after they know, now we're still presenting this shit to the public. And the public is buying into this because the label knows that Shock and Humpty are the same guy, but a lot of people in the public don't. And all the rest of that shit. And so you got to understand that we took a time and we hustled. We took a down on his luck hustler, grifter, motherfucker. Because when I met Shock, he lived in like transient hotels, transient residential hotels, places I had to pass in my whole life and never even knew what that place was. I didn't know it was. So he was like living on the lowest rung of life that I've ever experienced being. And I'm not knocking him for that. I'm just saying, he was a transient, down on his luck grifter. And when I met him, at the end of the day, you know, we take this thing and we take this hustle and this kind, and we kind the world. At the end of the day, we're the pop star.
Those are the best guys in the world to do it, because you can come from the dirt. As long as you believe, you can achieve. You know, believe
me,
that's so real. To me, that's admirable.
But let me interject now. Wait a minute. Let me go back because you're absolutely right. People who do come from the earth, the salt of the earth, the ship, like my dad and my mom and probably your parents and other people that you've grown up, maybe, I don't know. But the idea of it all is, Shock, I don't believe, came from that, though. Shock, I believe, came from more of a hustle-ish type background in Tampa Bay. He was born in New York, and when he got a certain age, like 10 or something, like a lot of us, his parents got divorced. His father went to Tampa Bay, and this, that, and the other, and took the kids with him and his brother Kent. His mom stayed in New York, and then eventually got remarried and moved out here to Manhattan Beach. Because when Shock and I were down here, the whole time I'm thinking Shock is, you know, come from, you know, no, nothing. But we sleeping in my car. We're utilizing all of the good favor that I've created by people letting us crash at their house. They don't know him. They know me. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, and so then we go to his mom's house. And this one I kind of feel bad, too, because we go to his mom's house. And she in Manhattan Beach. I ain't never been to Manhattan.
Manhattan Beach is balling. It's balling.
And they got the big double.
Exactly.
Right. So I'm sitting over here with this motherfucker taking care of this thing. When I'm buying burgers, I got to buy his burger. And I'm not mad at that, because that's what band members and group members do. You know what I'm saying? I'm not mad with that. But what I'm seeing is, I go to this nigga house, and these people got to go over there. They rich. You know what I'm looking like? Like, what the fuck? You know what I'm saying? You know, but the thing was, is part of him being in the position he was in, because of him being a hustler and doing stuff, and he kept getting busted with credit card scams and different shit, and the people looking for him embarrassed his mama with her husband over there and embarrassed the situation, and she didn't want it. She's like, oh, when I met her, I felt so bad, because we knocked on the door. She has a real thick New York Brooklyn accent. And she's like, oh, Gwiggly, I hope you haven't darkened my doorstep to ask me for money. And I was and I felt really bad. Right? But families have this situation. Everybody's got situation. I'm not trying to cast aspersions on their family. His relationship with his family at that time was a bit of strain, because he was trying to be a hustler, this, that, and the other. They know the little boy is educated. They know he's smart as hell. There's no reason for him not to be, other than him just being rebellious. So he's out here being a hustler and attempting to do that stuff on some rebellious shit. He ain't had to be doing none of this. He could have been in Tampa Bay doing something. I'm sure probably would be an engineer or something somewhere.
I'm using that line, though. Do not darken my doorstep. I love that feeling. She checked his ass.
I hope you have not darkened my doorstep.
That was cap right there. That was, man, that was, man, that was cool.
Well,
that was great, man.
It made me feel kind of bad. It made me feel kind of bad. And, you know, and I was like, okay, so I'm still out
but
here.
But as he blew up, I bet she was very proud of him.
Let me tell you how much she was. She was so proud that every time we were on our way from Oakland to Europe on tour and had a layover here in LAX, she'd be there at LAX to have a drink with us or something. And then, you know, and then at the bar, right? And then we cut out and get on the plane and stuff. So she came around. And because, like I said, they knew that boy was special. You know what I'm saying? Shark's a real smart dude, and it don't take long to know that if you're around him, if he lets you know that, because he really would prefer you know him as Cool Shark G other than Smart Shark G.
Right.
You know, and that's just his persona. And ultimately,
so was he on drugs back then, man?
Not at all. Let me tell you something.
Was y'all taking
not at
like
all. I was.
Man, y'all was on some one-on-ones and shit.
Who shot you? Well, I would, but not him. He wasn't fucking with anything. That's why. Even though I can kind of recall when they kind of started fucking around with some of that X back in the day, because shocking them would mess with a lot of them white girls and white people and black people for a long time did different drugs. I mean, like niggas did.
That's true.
Certain shit,
acid,
and that's it.
All that other shit, acid and quaaludes. Yes, sir. Especially back in that era. So,
well, yeah,
I mean,
yeah, and
you
know, the
one-on-ones, all that other shit.
Well, you know, for me, black people did blow, did weed, maybe some hardcore niggas did some hop or something, but I didn't know them. But, you know, it was like some weed and maybe some blow. You know what I'm saying? Period. And then later, I guess people got into that crack, but they wasn't nobody out here getting down being competitive. The real deal is that the idea that I was shocking, and they started more with psychedelics, and all that shit, and then ultimately end up, because by the time that I found out what Shock was into, I was blown away, because I didn't know folks that did bath salts. I don't know folks who did crystal meth. I didn't know meth was the white people's thing.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? It was. I mean, it's everybody's thing, I gather now, but it was predominant. So bath salts and crystal meth and all that stuff, and you know, those drugs are just something that I wasn't, and I didn't know what the ill adverse effects of that was, and there was some real, like I went and looked up bath salts, and they show you that consuming bath salts, those people turn into cannibals and start eating people. I mean, I watched it on YouTube.
Yeah,
they
folks
were,
died off of that, man. It came and went because meth kind of took it over. It was cheaper. It was easier to get, and a lot of people,
Let me tell you this now. Wait a minute. Let me tell you something. The whole bath salts thing, for some reason, is predominantly a Florida thing. And it's very prevalent right now. And especially
in
Tampa.
No, it came to California, though. It was in California, too.
Yeah, okay.
It was definitely in California, too.
Okay, but you know what? Probably California is a lot more sophisticated than Florida. And at the end of the day, Florida still got some bath salts and all the rest of that shit. And I'm telling you, Tampa Bay is supposedly the main place for that shit.
Wow.
I'm like, wow. And so I'm looking and I'm seeing all this, you know, and it's really sad to know, because Shock and I, you know, I didn't know what was up with Shock, only so Shock passed. Only took when Shock passed. Wait a minute. When he passed, I spoke with his brother Kent. And Kent was assuring me how much Shock had really lost his mind towards the end. Not just that he died from drug overdose, but he had really lost, he wasn't in control of his mind like that, man. He wasn't lucid like that a lot. And it started getting worse and worse. And, you know, I kind of had an issue after he passed, or even before he passed, because we were launching Dumb. We were launching Digital Underground Next Generation. And I wanted Shock to come on and play some keys and do some stuff, all the rest of that. But I didn't know that he had lost it like that. So when I'm talking to him, I'm thinking it's just from being high and he was tripping. Or because I had been hearing that he was high, getting high and tripping and missing dates, doing stuff, all the rest of that. But so I figured that that's just what it was, you know. And like I said, there was always a kind of a healthy competitive thing between he and I in terms of when it comes to the art and all the rest of that. So I thought it was just ego, he and I going back and forth, but I didn't know he was not really with us like that. So,
you know, were you able to attend his funeral?
No, I was not. I was not able to attend. My wife had just come down with stage one breast cancer that same week, and we were dealing with that, and that was how that was more important than everything. Plus, I hadn't been vaxxed, and I'm still not vaxxed, but I hadn't been vaxxed, and Florida at the time was really rampant with that shit, and that's a huggy, feely. It wasn't right for me, and I really wish that I had it, and wish that I could have. I wanted to go, but my family and everybody was just kind of like, nah.
Wow.
And so I couldn't go. Like I said, and my wife, who was with me when I met Shock, and all the rest of that means more to me than anything. So at the end of the day, I mean, I've been married to the same woman since 1986. You know what I'm saying?
That's true love.
You know,
hey, man, let's get into some music, man, because we've been, you know, man, bumping our gums. Let me get into some Evolution, man. Dumb in the Bills. FM-ism. G. Lou, Tweet Cadillac, Chopmaster J. Check it out.
Let me see it. Let me see the Evolution. High, race to the top. Legacy will never stop. So too when I came to ride, counting blessings, building style, shining bright just like the stars, like the split the slide of Mars, slapping that nigga that play a part, you got no smarts, you got no art, separate myself, I make my mark, cause it's right here in a minute made, mix that drink with lemonade, putting in work with no breaks, love my life, not out of place, a purpose when I'm in your face, right on time, never late, throwing up to you, I state my case, cause I know I came to make it. Getting high, just to glow about it. Sun of the underground, get the show started. Live and direct, like drugs. Taking the facts, things not right, put you to test. Too dope, put off stress, elevate your soul. Let it manifest, cause it's go time. Nerves will be great and do shine. Bumping your speakers with the cool vibes. I've been shaking my ass, so I just might take this shit to a whole nother level. Let the bass beat in your trunk. We ain't looking for no trouble. Cause I know I came to make it.
Hi, this is Ronnie Laws, and you're listening to Life in Paradise on 93.3 FM. Elegant jazz, R&B, and all in between.
Hi, I'm Patrice Rushen, and where there is love, it's 93.2 Tweed FM, classic oldies, jazz, and all in between. Welcome to the After Six Cruise Mix.
Hello, everybody. This is Alpha Anderson, former lead vocalist of the group Chic, and you are listening to 93.2 FM.
My name is C-H-O-C-L-E-T, Patrice Bay, from Grand Central Station, and you are funking with 93.3 FM Spectacular Lowrider Oldie on the After Six Cruise Day. I've got my funk box with me, and I'm ready to dance. Can you handle that?
Hey, this is Chucky Booker, and you are listening to 93.3 FM, the After Six Cruise Mix, the only station that won't play no games on you.
Hi, this is Tyrone Williams of the Mighty Mass Production Band, and you are tuned into 93.3 FM. Spectacular Lowrider Oldies at their finest. So turn up the music on the After Six.
And I'm your host, Tweed Cadillac. We are privileged tonight to be in the company of Chopmaster J and also Dung, Sons of the Underground. G-Lo, can you send a shout-out to the sponsors for tonight's episode? We can't forget about the people that make this happen.
Yes, sir. First and foremost, BTP Media Group is in the building. Sir, Jeff Kwan, follow the movement. Follow everything they have going on all digital platforms, all platforms, BTP Media Group. Got to give a shout out to Stacey Adams, man. You know, the flywear still kicking, still going strong. Got me fly right now. Shout out to Stacey Adams. Go right now to the TweedCadillac.com website. Click on the link for Stacey Adams. See what they have on there and get you a nice discount, care of Tweed Cadillac. So go right now to TweedCadillac.com. Click on the link for Stacey Adams and get yourself hooked up. Christmas is coming up. The holidays are approaching. Get hooked up by Stacey Adams. Also, we got to give a special shout-out. Go ahead.
No, I said that's right, man. Go get your granddaddy.
Okay.
Go get your daddy some Stacey's, some ties, things of that nature. The link is right there. Click on that link, and you are hooked up. You hooked up to the hooked upest. They'll call you Mr. Wonderful if you come up the Thanksgiving. Coming to the Thanksgiving situation with some fly-ass Stacey's on. Knock it off, man. Go on, man. Go ahead. TweedCadillac.com.
That's right.
That part. Shout out to MagnificentWax.com, too. We got the wax, man. We got you hooked up on the clothes. Now we're going to hook your ride up, man. So holler at our folks, man. MagnificentWax.com. We'll get you a bottle of that nice wax, man, to shine the car up. They also have Magnificent Wax located in selected Walmarts across the country. So check your local Walmart as well. If not, just go to the website, MagnificentWax.com. Tell them Tweed Cadillac sent you, and they'll hook you up as well. We got to give a shout-out to Tweed, man, to One Stop Funk Shop, right?
Chocolate.
One Stop Funk Shop.
C-H-O-C-L-E-T. Brand Central Station, man, Patrice Banks. She's been holding this down for a while now. Got to give a big shout out to Makita Smith. Jasmine PR, JAZZMYNE.com. She's a publicist to the stars, over 23 years in the business. She loves us from Tweed Cadillac. I love me some Makita Smith. So y'all need to check her out, man. If y'all need artists, if y'all need PR work, 23 years in the business, she's a go-to girl. Man, we love her. Big shout-out to Fun Diggity, Funnel Cakes, family-owned and operated business. We have a virtual location now. We have a drive-through, cashless. We are unjackable. So believe me, you can't come and rob us. It's at 661 East 62nd Street in Los Angeles, California. We're available on DoorDash, Grubhub, Uber Eats, but we are completely cashless. So it ain't, you can't jack us. But peep this, man. You can call in your order, put it to the drive-thru, and it's all good, man. It's all good.
I love FunDiggity.com.
We also have the funnel cake mix available in selected markets and stores, or you can get it directly off of the website. And with that being said, we got Chopmaster J live on the premises. Now, let me get to a sensitive situation right now, sir.
Okay.
Are you ready to address what I want to talk about right now? Because I was kind of offended, and I need to know the truth. Can you explain to me the situation in regards to the proclamation and you wasn't invited for Digital Underground Day? What is that all about? You guys can speak on that. Because I can't see how they can rewrite history, put you out of the mix, and not want to give you a claim when you was there from the beginning. I do understand how groups go through their certain situations. I mean,
right.
Believe me, too near you not to hear you. I know how things happen.
Right.
But I want to know not how you felt about it, but why was it done? Because that's what the issue is. For somebody to snub you, that's what the issue is. Can you go into that for me, please, sir?
You know, for the most part, the faulty foundation that it was built on, when we get back to talking about management and production company, getting back to Golden Eagle, getting back to Atron, you know, it was weird. I'm gonna tell you, I hadn't spoke to Atron since 1997 or something, right? It's 97-98. Now, the last time, the last time I had spoken with Atron, just to show you, was Tupac was dead. He died in 96, and before Tupac had died, the Strictly Dope songs that I had in 95, I was in Japan. I was licensing those songs. This was before Pocket passed. But after Pocket passed, we had done a deal with some of these songs, the earlier Tupac songs that I had. And I called Atron, had him come to my house, gave him money to give to the other members of Strictly Dope, Ray Love, Dizzy, Layla, and Mr. Famous. And I gave him cash money to go give them money each and to get their information so I could give it right to the label and they could be paid directly from the label moving forward. Atron doesn't go give them the money. Not only does he not give them the money, but he badmouthed me to them and creates an adversarial environment with me with them. Then the next to the last, and I didn't know about that part, then later comes next to the last part, he goes, look, you know, based upon what happened with you with that, I was able to make my relationship good with Afeni again. And so now they want to bring you to the table. I'm leading up to what your answer with the proclamation. The idea of it all is that he brings me down there to L.A. I sit in a lawyer's office. Atron's sitting reading the paper while this lawyer is drawing up some kind of declaration saying that I didn't have any rights to do that. And I'm sorry I did that. And this kid Atron's like, well, you know, this is going to bring you back into the family with the feigning and this and that. I'm like, okay. I'm reading the document, though, after they drew it. I didn't know what they were drawing up. The guy was sitting there writing it like I was telling that to him. I said, I'm not signing this. I said, look, let me go home and bring this and I'll come back and sign it or whatever. So I left with it. So just the type shit that inkling of a couple too. So there happens to be moving forward when it comes to the proclamation. It just so happens that, you know, one of the cats that were assigned to draw up the proclamation, it was a very, very well-known journalist up in the Bay, Eric Arnold, and he's also a real stickler for the history of how things are. He's like a guy who procures and wants to maintain the right and the righteousness and the dignity of hip-hop, especially for the Bay Area. But Eric is a respected journalist for many, many, many years. You know, he's right up in there with P. Frank, right up in there with Timbisa Mishaka, right up in there with the Huru Maggie, Ricky Vincent, with Davey D, with Billy Jam. That whole Bay Area thing of pacemaking journalists, Daniel Smith, all those folks. And so he called me crying down and said, man, so I don't know. He said, but, you know, he said that, you know, Munn and Klee are put in charge to proofread the proclamation, and they requested that I remove your name from it. And he was like, he said he just didn't want me to be upset, man, with him, but he was very disappointed because it looked like the looting of a legacy. You know what I'm saying? And a large part of it, the reason why it's happening, because it's to perpetuate this narrative of divide and conquer, even in Shock's passing. So to get back to the conversation, I spoke with Atrin. I hadn't spoken with him in years. And I told him the different things that, you know, I told him how I look forward to the day and I would love to be come there to speak and to do, you know, to share. And he said, I don't think that's going to be able to happen, or this, that, and the other. And now this is before I found out my name was removed from the proclamation. This is before. So I talked with Atrin, and I'm asking him certain stuff, and I'm going, look, man. He said, look, quite honestly, Jimmy, what's going on is we fired up a digital underground committee that consists of a few digital underground members or people that came along after me, but primarily with Money B and his big cousin Klee and, you know, and others, who basically at the end of the day, Atrin knows that if I come and this, that, and the possibility of the truth coming out will make these people not be in support with him. But he sits up here and perpetuates this narrative tweet, and he basically explained to me that the people don't like the stuff that I say in interviews. They don't like me expressing myself and telling, and what I'm doing is telling the truth. I'm not keeping with the narrative they want to keep. Like, there was a Rolling Stone interview that we had done when Tupac went into the Hall of Fame, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And so I'm telling this story, but I'm not keeping with the narrative of what Shock and Munn and what Atrin would want to have, because I'm the one who will sit up and tell you that Tupac has the fucked up distinguished thing of being the only artist in pop history to have a number one album on the charts and incarcerated. It's like it's never happened before. They've had people who have had records that were out and were on the chart, but not ones that were number one that just beat out Bruce Springsteen and Madonna, and that their case came up for appeal. So when your case comes up for appeal when you're in prison, you get to bail a person, right? So the bail can be available again. You can bail them out. They have to sit. So I said, why was Tupac incarcerated with the number one album on the chart? If he got number one album back in them days, you know, it has to be selling like 300,000 to 400,000 copies a week to be that. So he's pulling in, and he on the wholesale side, he pulling in $3-4 billion a week, $3-4 million a week. So when his bail happened, I'm like, how come Atrin didn't bail him? That's what I asked. I asked the question. And I felt really bad for Pac, because I felt like the ball had been dropped on him, because I know that, you know, Pac went from being a humble, nice-ass kid to what can I do to help, to, you know, when he became successful, you know, he started, you know, Atrin, if you ain't at the Bills dealership by 4 o'clock, you fired. That kind of shit. So Atrin, it appeared that Atrin was much more comfortable with Pac being incarcerated, him not having to be accountable to Pac in that particular situation. And you know, and, you know, it's like, you know, and it was awful. So I speak with Atrin. I speak with Atrin after not talking for 20-something years. He's like, yeah, people don't like what you be saying. It's like, you know, why wasn't I there to bail Pac and this, that, and the other? And I, he's like, we didn't drop, he said, and just for history, we didn't drop the ball on Tupac, this, that, and the other. He was incarcerated, Jimmy. He was in prison, you know, and, you know, normally when you're in prison, you have a conviction and this, that, and the other. He said, so at the end of the day, like, it's just so, he said these words, it's just so fucking ridiculous. It's so fucking ridiculous to think that, you know, you could do that. And, you know, I mean, who ever heard of bailing somebody out of prison? And I said, man, the people that bailed it. You know what I'm saying? I guess you would have asked Suge or Jimmy Irby. Like, it's obvious that he was in a position to be bailed. The question is, why didn't you bail him while he's signed to you and you're making all this money off of him?
Right.
That's the fucking question. And that part is what they don't like. So what happens is, all them lies sound real good till the truth show up. And when the truth show up, motherfucker don't tell. If he can prevent the truth from showing up, he gonna do so. So he gonna sit up and tell all the little opinions. He gonna tell all the people, you know. And God bless Money B. I love Money B. I'm the guy who pulled Money B into Digital Underground. The idea of it all is that they're sitting up there protecting the gate around the situation, being given these lies and the promise of being able to, I guess, go out and still gig as Digital Underground or whatever it is they're doing, you know, and what have you. But, you know, the fact of the matter is, me showing up and being there means people are going to have to be accountable, and they don't want to be accountable, man. That's what that was about. So that was about greed and things of that nature. You know, I mean, as we speak, Tweed, you know about Sound Exchange and them companies, right, the royalty collecting company. And so their money sitting over there right now, for the people that performed on the record and did the things they did on the record, there's to be paid. So we found out later, just even with that there's been over $250,000 that's been paid out to supposedly to Shock, but really Atrin and his partners and them are the ones who collect that money. So at the end of the day, and they weren't entitled to all that money. You're supposed to share that with the two or three other people that helped make the record, or however many it was. So they ain't done it. So now we put a claim in and froze the money at Sound Exchange, and we going after that. It's like it's all awful, man. But it's greed. It's greed that is the reason why it was done, and it's the looting of a legacy is why it was done, and they feel as though he'll tell you, well, Shock didn't want Chop to have this throw. That's a lie. That's not true at all. And it's obvious that Shock and I got along at some point, you know what I'm saying, enough to keep people still eating from this table. So, you know, it's just a bunch of unappreciativeness, even from how we started this conversation earlier when we were talking from the top about being appreciative of being here. You know what I'm saying? About being appreciative of the opportunities that come in front of us and taking advantage of them, utilizing it, but not taking advantage of people and not misusing people, utilizing. You know what I'm saying? I mean, it's like, God damn. So Atrin basically proved that he hadn't changed in the last from day one. And the work, and that's not being a dope businessman. What that really kind of is a person, because I was offering to Atrin, I said, look, Atrin, I offered all kind of olive branches. You understand? I'm the one that's been screwed, but I've been offering olive branches. And so I'm going, hey, this is a great story. We can talk about how we came back together after all this shit and won't do and boom, 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 boom. And so too, and Doug next, DU Next Generation is poised to take on this rest of this shit and move it forward and just keep it moving, because I feel more like Gene Roddenberry, right? It was Star Trek, right? Then there's Star Trek Next Generation, there's Star Trek Deep Space Nine, there's Star Trek. So at the end of the day, I'm looking at keeping it moving, period. You know, and
how come you didn't show up? How come you didn't show up at the proclamation?
Well, you know,
Were you able to do it at the time?
Yeah, I was able to do it, but I didn't. You know, he basically told me I would not be able to come on stage and do nothing. I wouldn't. So I would. To me, it felt like I would just be out there looking thirsty, walking around. And
basically,
I didn't even want to grace it that way. That's why Makita, the goddess, my support, she basically explained, no, you got to do this like this. And we went on and ended up at TMZ, and people see the foulness in it all, and it'll all come out because it is similar to the Jerry Heller NWA dismantling of the culture.
Right. So what did Money B say about it? You know, man,
Money
did he have your support and your backer or what?
Money B.
Did he roll with you? Did he roll with you?
From what I know and from what I can tell, it appears as if Mun is rolling with Mun. And like Mun is always rolling with. And at the end of the day, that means that if Atrin is giving Money B some opportunities to be able to benefit from the brand that he put time in, he put time in. Mun was basically been like a lifelong employee of the group. He views himself as the founding guy, but he's not. At the end of the day, he is a person that's been dedicated and loyal to the situation, you know, and all the rest of that. And so, you know, but, you know, the real deal is it's not
note.
Really.
He didn't play one note on nothing. He didn't play a note
He rapped on some songs, but at the end of the day,
I'm
he
talking
was
about rapping. I'm talking about musically. The nigga didn't play
tambourine.
He didn't play a tambourine.
Right, right, no. None of that. And at the end of the day, Mun was when we went and recruited when Mun got in the group, we went to go recruit Fuse, the DJ, and Mun was and him and were tight. And so the DJ was like, "Well, I'm not going nowhere without Mun." And so we basically saw where Mun could be because they were dancers too. Him and another dude with Mac Mullen were dancers in the crew that they had. So we snagged them to come out as doing that. And Mun got in there and he got in where he fit in. And God bless him, he worked it, and he did his thing. But at the end of the day, right about now, he and Atrin looks like they've aligned themselves. And it's kind of sad, and I won't blame anyone for doing what they did other than Atrin. And I know that it's wrong, and this, that, and the other. But we decided to just take the high road, man, and keep it moving. And we'll be able to show that we can do the next stuff. I am so sorry that I didn't really communicate more on my man Tweet, because I wanted to send you even like more stuff that music that I think that you like. Let me tell you something. Digital Underground Next Generation Dung.
I got all of that, but we talked so much tonight too. Man, I got it all right
now.
After hours. We might get
I'm talking about moving forward though, in the future. In the future, I'm just talking about as it pertains to what's up. They are and we are poised to go out here and go kick some real ass and carry the brand. We're the best suited to carry the brand forward. And we have all
the personality,
charm, and fun. Huh?
Speaking of the brand, what is your consensus on Young Hump? Are you affiliated with him in any manner? Because
let
he's
me
out
tell
there,
you, Chris,
you know, he got the nose
Chris,
on and all of that.
Yeah,
what's
I don't particularly
on,
care
man?
For it. I don't care for it. How
so
do you like?
You related to Shock G? Is how did he come to become Young Hump? I'm just curious, man, to actually know that part of the game.
Okay, so back to Atrin, and Rodney Franklin. Rodney Franklin was the cat that was being mentored by Stanley Clark and George Duke for a while, and based upon different things, Rod became doing his own thing and, you know, got consumed in his own lifestyles and stuff and basically alienated Stanley Clark and George Duke, or they just went different directions. But Atrin, at that time, this is all around some of the same time, Atrin started working for Stanley Clark as well, like later. He started working with Stanley because he was with Stanley and George Duke when they were working with Rodney, right? Because he was Atrin was Rodney's road manager back in the day. And so
that was the school days.
The School Days are one of my favorites, absolutely. But I'm talking about Atrin started working with
Sweet Days with George Duke and Stanley.
That was
84, together.
Yeah.
Yeah,
okay,
that
so
was
right
that
after
was a song right there. That was an
right, after
song
the,
right there.
Right, after that, somewhere in 85, 86 or so, 87, 88. So somewhere in there, Atrin started working with A-Rodney started working with George Duke and them around 85 or so. And so Atrium was able to build a relationship with Stanley Clark. Okay, move forward. So Stanley has a son named Chris Clark, who is Young Hump. And
wow,
so Young Hump is Stanley
that.
Clark.
I never
Stanley
knew
Clark's
that.
Son.
Wow.
And that
wow.
is based on a relationship between Atrium working for his father, working for Stanley, also Chris being someone who is immensely talented, because I knew of him rapping when he would carry his dad's bass up to Oakland and the Yoshis and set it up for his dad's performances. And then at the end of the show, his dad sometimes would bring him out and Chris would come out and freestyle, and he was good. And he's got his own legitimate skill set and this, that, and the other. Through the time and the relationships between Stanley and Atrium working together, Shock becoming reluctant to want to go out and perform, Chris, not necessarily having his own career blossom in his own way, decided to put together something that they thought was a cool idea of allowing him to be Young Hump, and they went and got Money B, and he said, well, y'all should go out as Money B and Young Hump, so this way Chris can be making money and doing stuff and getting off his daddy couch.
Wow.
At the end of the day, you know, and all that. So that was, and for me, I don't particularly care for it. What do you think of it?
Well, personally, when I looked at it, and I'm like, okay, he took on a persona. I mean, okay, I got that part of it, why it was going down. What tripped me out was that Money B was right there next to him in the video supporting it as if it was all good. And I always
right.
thought, okay, well, Money B, I know that you probably wanted your own solo career, which really didn't blossom to bloom to whereas you probably would have wanted to do. Because like Fife Dawg, Tribe Called Quest, I'm sure Fife wanted his own shit too, because Q-Tip went solo on him. So I understand
right.
the dynamic of being in a group and want to do what you want to do, because I did it.
Right.
I had to
right.
transfer printouts to do my own thing as well. I got the dynamic
right.
of all of that. I just didn't understand why Money B was next to Young Hump. That was my always the questionable shit that I thought about. And I couldn't wait to ask you that. You was with
uh-huh.
the real Hump, and now you with Young Hump. And it's like, are
right.
you just trying to just keep yourself relevant, or is cookies on the table for you? Which I'm sure probably is. Because now you can go and do shows with Young Hump. But it's like, dude, this industry, man, it's crazy. That's basically
well,
all I can say. It's crazy.
Right. Well, the bottom line is that it's a contrived situation. It maybe at the best it was cute while Shock was still alive or whatever. But now the Shock is gone, and it's and yes, it really seems to have been an idea or concept that's played out. And or tweet. What I had expressed in the out part of the outlet branch was because Munn came and rapped on a song or two with Digital Underground Next Generation. He came and he got down. It's up because Munn is down with Munn. And the real deal is, and I love him, I ain't got no problem with that. But the idea of it all is that, you know, to me, I even said, look, we all should come and we can do, when we do a DU medley, yeah, that's when y'all come out and bust that shit out, and then y'all back out. It's
exactly.
the next generation.
And y'all could have a complete,
you know,
stage show put together, and everybody could eat. So what's on the
exactly.
horizon, man? What y'all going to do other than Sons of the Underground? I know Dunn got some heat, man. I got it loaded up right now. We got about 5 minutes. I probably can go to the Underground until they shut us off. But look, what's on the horizon, man, for you personally? Is it all about Dungey now, or what?
Yeah, it's definitely about launching that in the Chopmaster J Legacy series. We're going to get on deck, and I'm going to be wanting to work with you and plug in on stuff when we get to doing this podcast thing, which we're getting ready to start. But also, I do have a bunch of new stuff that I have recorded with George Quentin. We got a new dance called The Nigger, I've got a bunch of stuff that I have recorded with Dave Hollister, because, you know, I went on and did a deal with Quincy Jones back in the day, and we had a song called spirit does anybody care in the Boys in the Hood movie, which is the 30th anniversary of Boys in the Hood. So I'm celebrating 30 years, 30 plus, in the career, in my thing with a whole body of work that have consisted with George Clinton, Dave Hollister, Digital Underground, Dung, So Too, Big Brother Soul, you know, all kind of different guests, El DeBarge and different people. I got a plethora of content that we coming with. And now that I know that I'm checking out you, that I'll be listening to y'all moving forward. And I love the music that you in your tag. And I love put on there Ronnie Law's Big Stars One Day. I love that song.
Man, and, my shit is Wind Parade and Places and Spaces. And the
Yeah,
Black
no
Birds,
doubt,
but,
no doubt.
But
no
look,
doubt. All of all
you
bring
of Rodney to the table. I would love
yeah.
to interview Rodney. Man, I
yeah,
would
now
love,
Rodney's up there in the
man,
bay. He
that.
Up there in the bay. We can definitely get him up on to be in the building, as you put it,
well,
on,
you
on the premises.
You need to make that happen. Chop, you need to make
right,
that happen
right.
for me, man. That'd be a great
right,
thing.
I'm going to do that.
Tell him that he in good hands. Tell him that he in good all hands. Right. I'd interviewed everybody from Rodney to Surface, Chucky,
right.
Jim Breeze, Climax, Orange Juice Jones, Barcade. If I keep on talking, it's going to sound like I'm bragging. Tell him he in
no,
good
but
hands.
You, exactly. I know we at the end of this, but I'm saying the one thing I try to convince Rodney, because Rodney is such a jazz masterful musician type dude, that at the end of the day I'm saying, you don't understand, man. If the Bay Area knew that you are a large part of the reason of Tupac, because it was through your production company, it was through this, that, and the other, I say you would be hot as well, again, just for being the person to help bring him to the table. You know, period. And I mean, I think that would really add to your legacy the way he said. So that's why our documentary that we're going to be having coming out, we're going to be, like you asked me, what am I doing? I'm going to be doing some Shock G tributes and little stories and little things put together with some pictures and music. And we're going to lead up into Black History Month next year. And really, in January, from January on, it's going to be a Chopmaster Legacy series popping. And I do want to hook with you, and even though I'm down here in L.A., it don't mean that we can't meet somewhere in the middle and have that drink.
Man, it's going to go down like Bobby Brown. Man, tell the people, yeah. man, how they can reach out and touch you if needed.
Yeah, they can reach me over at Chopmaster J's Instagram. I got a Chopmaster J Instagram page. You know, I'm also over there at... I guess YouTube and Facebook, all of them. We're at all the platforms for the most part, and the Done So Too material is where it needs to be over at Spotify and things of that nature. So, you know, we up in there.
All right, well, add me on everything. I'm easy to find too, man. Tweak Adlike everything. Instagram, Facebook, tweakadlike.com. Find G Lou, my co-host, at the glushow.com. He does a hip-hop show on Wednesdays. He does
okay.
After Hours and Old School Sundays. So, G. Lou, man, you got any words? G. Lou, you there. Okay, he must have clocked out. Hey, look, man.
It's all good.
It's been a pleasure. I got your number, 4848, right? That's you?
Right, for sure.
Done deal, man. I'm going to lock
you in. Hit me up, man, so we can start building.
Man, I'm going to do that, man. Area code going to be 661, although I'm in
okay.
Santa Rosa, man. It's going to be me, sir.
I got you.
Man,
absolutely.
Much love out again to Bikita Smith. She make it happen.
The goddess.
She's probably on the pole right now. She might be on the pole right now, but she make it happen. Jazz, NYNEPR.com.
That's right.
Public Relations. 94 Sweet FM ism. Good night. God bless y'all, man.
Peace and respect.
All right. I'll holler back at you, Pippin.
All right, now.
Yes.